So let's talk about the book of Daniel. And I hope, like I said, that you guys have read the chapters. It's really important. It's not too much homework. The book of Daniel is not just history. It's not just history. It's a training manual for myself. It's a training manual for believers living in a world that pressures us to compromise with the world system. We all know it. We see it on social media. We see it in our schools today. We see it in businesses. Daniel shows us how to stand, then how to discern, and then how to remain faithful in our, and I'll say this very clearly, pagan culture. We live in a pagan culture. Daniel lived in a pagan culture. These first three chapters absolutely lay the foundations for understanding Revelation. Really important. Because Daniel gives us the patterns we're going to see. We're going to see the foreshadows in the book of Revelation. The kingdom timelines. Daniel starts it all. Revelation explains it and completes it. So it's an amazing thing. It's the two bookends of understanding prophecy. It really is. There's a lot in between of all that. It's one of the most contested books of the Bible because it so accurately, you think about chapter 11, it so accurately predicts what goes on 300 to 400 years in the future of him. And it's even to the point where it predicts history that's going to happen in our lifetime or beyond. I don't know if it's going to happen in our lifetime. I'm not a predictor, but we know that it is going to happen. And you're going to see in the book of Daniel how history unfolds before it even happens. Do you know that it predicts the actual day that Jesus came? And I'm not talking about, but the actual day that Jesus comes into Jerusalem riding on a donkey, all of Israel proclaimed in him the king. That's the actual day that happens to the T. You're going to see also his death in the book of Daniel. You're going to see the Messiah's death in the book of Daniel. I'm very much amazed that the Jews don't recognize a lot of this and pin it to Jesus Christ. It's such an amazing book that the detractors attack Daniel's authorship. They say, oh, he couldn't have wrote this. It's too accurate. Because you can, chapter 11, we're going to get into, and it's very accurate to the different kings, the north and the south, and different kings that happened during that period of time. It's so accurate that they say, there's no way Daniel could have wrote this. Someone after those things happened had to write it and just fill in the history. But see, Jesus comes to our rescue in all of this and proclaims Daniel was the author of the book and also that he verifies the prophecies and the future events that are happening in the book of Daniel. I'm going to stick with Daniel, with Jesus. That's a fact. People say, well, he couldn't have wrote it. Jesus said he did write it, and that these prophecies are going to come true. The book of Daniel is a prerequisite for the book of Revelation. It's a prerequisite. And that's our intention this morning. Our title today is the book of Daniel, chapter 1, 2, and 3. And in those three chapters, we're going to see the faithfulness of in a world of compromise. Think about how the world wants to shape us right now, how it wants to make us compromise to the world system. That's chapter one. Chapter two, God reveals the future of the nations. There's going to be four kingdoms. You could say four and a half because you're going to have the Roman Empire rise up in latter days. So God reveals the future of the nations. He knows what's going on. He knows what, from the beginning to the end, what's going to happen. And he's designed it in such a way that he is going to be the last kingdom on earth. And that kingdom is never going to go away. It's going to be with us for eternity. And then that's chapter two. And then chapter three, we're going to experienced this morning standing in the furnace, right? We're going to experience that. Maybe. So let's look at first faithfulness in a world of compromise. And I'm going to read a little bit of the first chapter. It says, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, that's the king of Judah, into his hand. And some of the articles of the house of God, that would be the temple in Jerusalem, which he carried into the land of Shinar, and land of Babylon, to the house of his God, and he brought the articles into treasure house of his God. Then the king instructed Aspenaz, the master of the eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles, young men in whom there is no blemish, but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge, and quick to understand, who had the ability to serve in the king's palace, whom they might teach the language and the literature of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed for them a daily provision of the king's delicacies and of the wine which he drank, and 3 years of training for them, so that at the end of that time they might serve before the king. However, from among those that were of the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. To them, the chief of the eunuchs gave names. He gave Daniel the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah, Shadrach, to Mishael, Meshach, and to Azrael, Abednego. Now, the book of Daniel begins with a crisis. It begins with the crisis. Jerusalem falls to the mighty kingdom of Babylon. And it would be the first time that it fell under Jehoiakim. I don't know if you guys know who Jehoiakim's father was. It was Josiah. Josiah was a righteous king. And if you remember King Josiah, he was the greatest king, the Bible declares, since David. And he brought great revival to the land of Judah. It was in disrepair. It was in pagan worship. One generation later, everything falls apart. One generation later. Yet verse 2 reminds us, if you look at verse 2, it says, the Lord gave Jehoiakim into his hand. It was the Lord that allowed that. God is sovereign even when the culture collapses. So you get these young men. They're taken 500 miles away from their home, from Jerusalem. They're taken away into Babylon. And Daniel is one of the captives. Daniel is of the tribe of Judah. He would be of the kingly or the royal line. Think about this now. You're taken 500 miles away to a strange land. You're probably 12, 13, or 14 years old at the time. Just young men. He's from the tribe of Judah, so he lived in probably the palace. And his world collapses, yet God is still directing the story. He's still directing the story. You know, we can have a lot of things happen in our life, but God is in control. He's always in control. Israel's captivity was predicted centuries before. Actually, in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, it was warned that if you worship pagan gods, I will carry you away to another land. And then Isaiah actually predicts that to Hezekiah that I'm going to take your sons and I'm going to give them into Babylon and they're going to serve the Babylonian king. Proverbs 21:1 says that God directs the kings like the rivers of water. He can go any way he wants to go. When we look at the world as being so crazy and so upheaval, God is in control. He's totally in control. He never loses control. So Daniel's story begins with a great loss, but it's not a defeat. God often brings his greatest work in seasons that feel like captivity. You guys ever gone through a captivity in your life where you feel like you're far away from God? and you don't sense him, you don't sense his presence. Now, Nebuchadnezzar uses this strategy that looks familiar today in our world with our children. Young men, right, 12, 13, 14, we don't know the exact age, but they were young. Very first thing that Nebuchadnezzar does is he has this isolation. He removes Daniel and his three friends from any godly influence. Remember, in Jerusalem, it was pretty bad, but there was some godly influence. But taken to a faraway land, that godly influence, and you know, the world wants to separate our children from godly influence. The second thing, and boy, this is really striking home, I have a 14-year-old granddaughter, indoctrination, the school indoctrination. She goes to a public school, and I hear her sometimes parrot some of the things that they're teaching. And this indoctrination, they teach them from, they taught them from the Babylonian worldview. It's not any different. We live in a Babylonian worldview today. So you got this isolation, you got the indoctrination, you have indulgence. They fed them on the king's delicacies. So if you think about that, you know, you think especially about America, you start to think about the riches that we have in this country. Even a poorer family is rich compared to the rest of the world. But Satan would love to feed us the indulgence of the world. And then finally, I just put down identity theft or identity change. They rename each kid a different that is associated with the Babylonian god. So this is how ungodly cultures reshape a whole generation. They change their environment, they change their thinking, they change their appetites, and then they change their identity. It's the same tactic that Satan uses today, especially in our children. Listen to this. I don't know if you guys ever heard the Barna Group. They take surveys. They take surveys. But some of the stuff, they take Christian surveys. It's interesting. 83% of Christians make their first commitment to Jesus before the age of 18. 83%. Very rare to see an older person that hasn't done that come to Christ. 43% come to Christ before the age of 12. That's something to really consider as you raise your children. After age 19, only 6% of people ever make a commitment to Jesus Christ. So it's those young, impressionable years that's so important for the child to know Jesus. So it's no wonder that Satan goes after the children. And if you have kids, and I'm not saying if you have kids, if you have the kids, you have a whole generation. You get the generation. So Daniel makes one of the greatest decisions in Scripture. Look at verse 8. It says, Daniel purposed in his heart. Daniel purposed in his heart. He decided ahead of time that he would not defile himself. Now, the king's table was ungodly for the Jews. It was ungodly. It was things that they weren't supposed to partake in. So Daniel decided ahead of time, he purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself. And he goes through this whole thing with the master about not doing this and see how we check out afterwards. So though he was in the Babylonian system, he never became part of that worldview. You know, we're in the world today, but we don't have to be part of the world. The Bible says that we can remain separate from that. We have to be in the world. We have to pay our bills. We have to go to work. We have to do all these things in the world, but we don't have to be part of the world. So Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not be part of that world. And so he was in the Babylonian system. He never became part of that. He remained separate from that. He learned about that. He became wise in a lot of different ways. And God honored that conviction. First of all, and we're still in chapter 1. Remember, this is a summary. It's hard for me to not go down many different avenues with this because there's so much there. And that's why it's important to read these chapters. But God honored that conviction. God honored Daniel's conviction and the three friends. He gives Daniel favor. That's in verse 9. He gives all four of those guys wisdom. That's in verse 17. God promotes them. If you look down on 19 and 20, verse 19 and 20, he promotes them. And then also God gives Daniel, we don't know about the other three, but God gives Daniel longevity. He lived probably into his 90s. So we're talking about starting off as a young 12, 13, 14-year-old and lived all the way into his 90s, we think. And he lived into the reign of the Persian king, Cyrus. So you see the blessings of not compromising. These four young men were faithful in a world that really has a lot of challenge for us. So that's chapter one. Chapter two, God reveals the future of the nations. Now, this is interesting. This is going to be really important in your study of the book of Revelation. Now, in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. And his spirit was so troubled that his sleep left him. Then the king gave the command to call the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dream. So they came and stood before the king. And the king said to them, I have a dream, and my spirit is anxious to know the dream. Then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic. Now, this is kind of interesting. This is a little sidebar. But from chapter 2, verse 4, to the end of chapter 7, the book of Daniel was written in Aramaic. You have most of the book written, this is the Old Testament, up to this point in Hebrews. And then after chapter 7, the end, verse 28, it's written in Hebrew. But in between, this is written. And there's reasons you could get into this, but it's written in Aramaic. That was the common language of the time. Then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic. O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will give the interpretation. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, my decision is firm. If you do not make me known the dream to me and its interpretation, you shall be cut to pieces, and your houses shall be made an ash heap. Nebuchadnezzar had a lot of power. He had a lot of power. So chapter 2, we had the history of the nations according to God. You'll see that all the way through verse 49. And this becomes our backbone for Bible prophecy. It's important to understand this. It gives us the timeline of world empires from Babylon all the way to the second coming of Christ, all the way through. But we have this Nebuchadnezzar's dream, and it's a divine revelation to the Babylonian king from God. It's a divine revelation. You know, you see this in the Bible in different parts. You think about Joseph back in Egypt, in Exodus, where he interprets the two times, the two seven-year spans from Pharaoh, the good 7 years and then the bad 7 years. But Pharaoh tells Joseph about the dream, and then Joseph gives the interpretation. But this is a little bit different. There's a little twist here. The king demands the impossible. Tell me the dream, what I dreamed, and the interpretation. And that is, you think about that. Look at verse 7. They answered and said, let the king tell us the servants the dream, and we will give the interpretation. Now, here's where I agree with Nebuchadnezzar. They're stalling. And these wizards have the power, they think they have the power of interpretation. They should have the power of revelation also. Now, you got the horoscope people. You know who I'm talking about, right? You see the little signs along streets where, hey, I'll tell your fortune, different things like that. They always talk in generalization where you end up filling in the blanks. Do you ever notice that? They do that. Here's what I would ask from these people. If you are so true, why haven't you won the Powerball jackpot, right? Think about that. I mean, if I had this gift, I would probably be picking some numbers. That's not it. These soothsayers, they're nothing more than yes men. That's all they're going to just tell the king what he wants to hear. This is a very desperate situation, though. The edict from the king to slaughter all the Chaldeans, it includes Daniel and his three friends. It includes those. So it's a desperate situation. The edict from the king was to slaughter all the wise men of Babylon. And you got to love Daniel's response to a very desperate situation for such a young man. Now, we don't know how, is it past the 3 years? I would imagine. So he's 16, 17, 18 years old, somewhere in there. But I love his spiritual maturity. In when you look at Daniel 2, verse 14 and 15, there's this calmness over Daniel. He says, why is the decree from the king so urgent? I think he's just, hey, let's slow down a little bit. Let's calm down a little bit. So there's this calmness about Daniel. And I'm thinking, he's thinking in the back of his mind that God is the answer to all of this. Why is this decree so urgent from the king? But then you see in verse 16, you see that practical knowledge. So Daniel went in, asked the king to give him time that he might tell the king the interpretation. So there's this, you know, when we have practical, when we have the spiritual maturity, we need to have that practical application. And so he's calm about it. And then he goes into the king after thinking, probably praying about it. Hey, how about a little bit of time and I'll give you the interpretation. But by far the most important thing, you look at verse 17 and 18, Daniel and his three friends do a prayer meeting. They have a prayer meeting and they get together and pray. And then in verse 19, you have this patience of Daniel. It says that the secret was revealed to Daniel in a night vision, so Daniel blessed the God of heaven. He blessed the God of heaven. And then also you see this praise that Daniel answered and said, blessed is the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. So Daniel doesn't panic. He trusts. That's what he does. He trusts. He doesn't panic. He prays. Boy, this should be a pattern for all of us, right? No panic, just prayer. That should be the pattern that we all live by. I'm not saying that it's that easy, because some of the things that God throws in our lap are pretty heavy. They're pretty heavy, but God is in control. So God reveals the dream, and he reveals this prophetic timeline stretching thousands of years. And this is what's really important about the, you'd say, the four kingdoms, the backbone of prophecy. You could put up that one, next one, more, yeah. I stole that. I didn't draw that, you guys. You know, I don't know even know where I got it. I've had it for a while. But it actually shows the four kingdoms that they're going to talk about. Now, remember, in Daniel's time, the ruling empire is Babylon. So the statue represents the four kingdoms. Now, this is verse 31 to 45. And the reason we know all this, because most of this is written history. It's already passed. Not all of it. But most of it is written, and it even gets more detailed when you get into the further chapters of Daniel. So if you look at it, the head of gold, that's verse 37 and 38, is Babylon. And it's interesting when you look at the metals, it goes downhill. It goes from gold, silver, bronze, and then it goes to iron, which is a much more common. So, and there's reasons for that too, that the Babylonian Empire was an empire of absolute rule. It was just Nebuchadnezzar, whatever he said went, no matter what. So you got the head of gold, Babylon. Daniel, what, 37 and 38? You got the chest and arms of silver. Now, it's interesting because you got the Mede, and then you got the Persian Empire. It was a conglomeration of two empires together, the Mede and the Persian. And that's why you got the arms there. You got the belly and the thighs. That's Greece. We all heard of what? Alexander the Great. He was the one they're talking about here. Greece was verse 29. Then you got the legs of iron. Now, we all know this because all this history has already passed. The legs of iron, you got Rome. And legs, you got the Eastern Empire and you got the Western Empire. The Eastern Empire stayed 1,000 years later than the Western Empire. So the Eastern Empire was in Turkey. It was in Turkey. So though the last one, and you got, I don't know if you can see it too well, but you got a mixture of iron and clay on the feet. Remember 10, that's going to be important later on. That'll be on your test when we're all, no. That's very important to understand because there's going to be this feet of iron and clay. It's a 10 king confederation, latter day revived Roman Empire. Somewhere in Europe, this is going to rise up and they're going to have these 10 nations that are going to be ruling the world. And we'll see that definitely in the book of Revelation. Now, and that's, you see that in 41 to 43. That, all of those have taken place, the four in the beginning have taken place and are in the pages of history. The legs of iron is not even happening in our day. We don't know where it's actually happened. A lot of speculation on who these 10 king confederation is going to be, but we know it's going to come out of the revived Roman Empire. And when I say that, mostly Europe. Well, Roman Empire was pretty much spread all around. So we're going to see it somewhere pop up like that, somewhere down the road. We'll see this in Revelation quite clearly, you might say. So this is the prophetic skeleton of Revelation chapter 13, chapter 17, chapter 19. There, you'll see that. I love the last one, though. The stone cut without hands. You see that? What are you standing on? All of that, that's the kingdom of Jesus Christ. And that's Christ's kingdom. That's in 44 and 45 of chapter 2. It says that in the days of those 10 kings, which haven't arrived yet, Jesus returns. He comes back. That's his second coming, destroys all the kingdom of men, and establishes a kingdom that will never, ever, ever be destroyed. So it's really, that statue represents exactly what chapter 2 is all about. Daniel 2 shows us that history is not random. It's controlled by God. He knows exactly what's going to happen. He's going to raise up kings. He's going to put down empires. They rise and fall at the command of God. We think America rose up, was a really godly influence in the very beginning. It's deteriorated. Eventually, the United States will fall. We don't know when. Most nations have about a 200 to 300 year recycle period. And we can see what happens. We looked at Rome. They taxed everybody. Immorality just boosted everywhere. And pretty soon, they deteriorated, and they are no more like they were. So the empires rise and fall at the command of God. He raises them up and he puts them down. Interesting, he raises up the Babylonian Empire to chastise Israel and Judah. And then he raises up the Mede-Persian Empire to chastise Babylon because they chastise Israel. It's kind of interesting, but if you look at that, that's the way it works. Empires rise and fall at the command of God. And I'll tell you what, the final empire will be Jesus Christ. It will be Jesus Christ. That's the end of the matter. Now, chapter 3, I put a little subtitle, Standing in the Furnace. So Nebuchadnezzar, this is verse 1, the king made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits, and its width 6 cubits. And he set it up in the plains of Dura, in the province of Babylon. And King Nebuchadnezzar sent words to gather together the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image with which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So everybody from everywhere where the Babylonian Empire was, they were required to come and come to this dedication of the image. So the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the province gathered together for the dedication of the image of King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image and that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then a herald cried out, "To you it is commanded, O people, nations, and languages, that at the time you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the harp, the lyre, the psaltery, in sympathy or symphony with all the kind of music, you shall fall down and worship the gold image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of the burning fiery furnace." So at the time when the people heard the sound of the horn, the flute, the harp, the lyre, they all worshiped, they all fell down, and they worshiped the gold image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Here's where faith meets the fire. This is where faith meets the fire. It's also very prophetic, and I'm trying to draw in a lot of references, Revelation chapter 13, that they would have to worship what we call the beast or the Antichrist. So sometimes after the dream, it's very interesting. Nebuchadnezzar's image represents pride and rebellion. It's gone to his gold head, you might say. It's gone up to Nebuchadnezzar's mind. So sometime after the dream, he builds a 90-foot gold statue. It's out of gold. It's not out of silver. It's not out of bronze. It's not out of iron like the dream. It's all gold. It's all Babylon, all Nebuchadnezzar. That's what it's about. Nebuchadnezzar said, well, God predicted that Babylon would fall, and then the Mede-Persians would come in. But Nebuchadnezzar said, not if I can help it. That's what he's really saying in building this image. So the kings gather all the officials, they play the music, the demands of worship. This is cancel culture, except it's got a furnace, right? We just get canceled out in our day. This is a furnace. And Revelation 13 mirrors it exactly, an image worship that's demanded death for refusal. And Daniel 3 is the prototype. Revelation 13 is the final version of this. But we have faith, you know, that walks into the fire. You got Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They refuse to bow. Their declaration, and this is in verse 17, God is able to deliver us from your word. He is able to deliver us from your word. But then he goes on in verse 18, but if not, we're not going to obey you. We're not going to obey you. We will not bow. And that's in verse 18. So what do? They heat up the furnace 7 times more, and they are thrown in. They're thrown in bound. But instead, well, and you think about it, the guys that were thrown in, those three guys, crispy critters, they got burned up. It was so hot that they couldn't even get near it. So it was a real hot furnace. But instead of three, Nebuchadnezzar sees 4 in the furnace. The truth is, there was always 4 in the furnace. There was always 4 in the furnace. A lot of people think that this is Jesus Christ in the furnace with them. You know, we had different parts of the Old Testament where we see where Abraham entertains the Lord. We think that that's a pre time of Jesus Christ that he appeared in the Old Testament. He's God. He can do whatever he wants. So, but if not, we're not going to bow to you. This is where, when you think about four in the furnace, this is where Isaiah chapter 43 is an amazing book, or I should say chapter in Isaiah. It becomes literal. When you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned. Right? You remember that in 43? And they come out even without the smell of smoke. They walk out. And this is where Nebuchadnezzar speaks again in verse 28. Is Nebuchadnezzar saying, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego." Let me just say, if you read these stories, these narratives in there, you need to sit and just think about it for a few minutes. And because, you know, I'm skimming over a lot of good stuff here, but it's necessary for us to get through this the way we're doing it. But blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel. And it could have been an angel. We think that it was Jesus. And delivered his servants who trusted in him. They have frustrated the king's word and yielded their bodies that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree that all the people, nation, or language that speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces. He's really into the cutting in pieces. And their houses shall be made an ash heap, because there is no other God that can deliver like this. So it gets turned around. It gets completely turned around. Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. That's in verse 30. So that's standing in the furnace. So that's what we looked at. Part one of Daniel, we looked at the faithfulness of a world of compromise in a world of compromise. Those four guys, they purposed in their heart that they would not compromise themselves. Then in chapter 2, you see the future of these nations that God predicted would appear and has appeared and will appear later on. And then we just talked about standing in the furnace. You know, faithfulness in compromise, or understanding the prophetic timeline, and then standing firm when the world demands surrender. These chapters prepare us really for life, and then even for the book of Revelation, because we're going to see a lot of the similar things. You're going to see the pattern of the world empires. You're going to see the pressure of false worship in the book of Revelation. You're going to see the protection of God's presence, the promise of Christ's kingdom. We're going to see all of that in the book of Revelation. You know, like Daniel, you have to purpose in your heart to seek God. I'm drawn back on our children, that we need to purpose in our hearts to seek God for them, because we're going to be the anchor for our children. And like his friends, you have to stand when they want you to bow, right? You have to stand when they want you to bow. We can't bow to the world. And that stone cut without hands, we are looking for. Boy, if I could only stir up everybody. I get stirred up when I start reading about this. We need to stir ourselves up that the Lord's coming back. In our lifetime, I have no idea. Next lifetime, three generations, I have no idea. But we need to stir ourselves up. One of the really good principles of the early church, they were waiting for Jesus to come back any day. And we need to have that in our hearts. So that stone cut without hands, we're looking for the kingdom that cannot be shaken. That's in verse 44. You know, someone once said, and I'll just conclude with this, that a martyr may die one time, but a believer must live faithfully every day. The real test is not dying for Christ. I mean, that if God would have that for us, that's an honor. But the real test is not dying for Christ. It's living for him in Babylon. And we are in Babylon today. Amen? You guys want to stand?